The appeals process is really completely inadequate to catch cases of wrongful conviction. A lot of people think that, you know, you got convicted, something went wrong at the trial, well, it's going to get caught on appeal. And it just doesn't work that way. Appeals are not about innocence or guilt. Appeals are about, were there technical errors made during the course of the trial? Was there a mistake in admitting or not admitting a certain piece of evidence? But they're not about the overall guilt or innocence of the defendant. So people often think that, well, this guy couldn't be innocent because he had all those appeals. And that's just completely wrong.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. I had intended to drop this episode of The Helpers next week and include my most recent interview with an exoneree this week. However, if you follow me on Twitter, you probably know that I experienced some car issues on the way there, and I wasn't able to make it to the interview. There is a helper that I want to acknowledge. On the way to the northern part of Michigan, my car had a blowout, and less than 5 minutes after I pulled over, there were flashing police lights behind me from an SUV that said Michigan State Police. The officer was so kind. She helped me change my tire and find a shop to replace it so I could come home. She went above and beyond. I wanted to give a big thank you shout out to Officer Marsha Linenbaugh for your help. On to the Bombas Kid of the Week. This week has two families worth of Bombas kids. My friends, Allie and Charlie, from the Insight podcast, are also huge Bombas fans and use this sponsorship as an opportunity to get Bombas socks for their own families. This is what their children had to say about it.
These are orange and black socks. When I walk, I feel a bit squishy, and they're very comfy, and Bombas.
The pink, the top is black, and the bottom is gray. The back has this soft thing, so you won't get, like, blisters from it, but then also it kind of makes it a little tighter, so then it cannot slip down so easily.
These are pink socks and they have highs on it, and when I walk, they're very soft on the tiles, and I love them.
I love that every time you buy a pair of Bombas socks, that someone in need also receives a pair. You can get a 20% discount by visiting www.bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com, and using the discount code ACTUAL. Using that code not only gives you a discount and someone in need a great pair of socks, but it also helps show Bombas that Actual Innocence is a podcast worth sponsoring. Now, back to The Helpers. Last time on The Helpers, I introduced Rachel Kamens, Colin Miller, and David Moran. They began to tell us about the appeals process. This episode will continue that discussion and teach us about other kinds of appeals and some legal jargon. I'm Brooke, and these are The Helpers.
Collateral appeal is based upon errors that are not evident from the trial record, namely ineffective assistance of counsel, and that is also called post-conviction review. So after that direct appeal, based upon things an appellate court could say, oh, I can look at the trial record and say that's an error, the defendant can then bring a collateral appeal, also known as post-conviction, where they're saying, well, here's some other stuff that aren't evident from the trial record, but if you dig deeper and look outside that record, I can point to these various errors that caused my conviction.
Well, there's only one direct appeal. And then after that, so in Michigan, it's typical, you have what's called a motion for relief from judgment. Other places call it state habeas. What this proceeding is going back to court, trying to overturn your conviction, and you are limited to grounds that you did not raise on a direct appeal. And you have to have good reasons why you couldn't have raised them on your direct appeal. So you can't save some of your best reasons for overturning your conviction for later. You're supposed to raise any issues that you know about on direct appeal. So that severely limits what you can do on post-conviction. And in many states, you can only file one post-conviction motion, and you can file one federal habeas. In Michigan, there's an exception to both of those things. There's also an exception in federal court that you can file further post-conviction motions if you find new evidence after you filed the first one. So if you filed one post-conviction motion, say, 2 years after you were convicted, and then 10 years later you discover new evidence, then you can file a second one.
So if you're out of options in the state court, can the federal courts help you?
Every defendant convicted in state or federal court can apply to the federal court to review their conviction. If you're convicted in state court, you can have the federal district court in your circuit review your case, but you're not automatically entitled to it. So they don't have to grant you a hearing, and they can just deny without a whole lot of fanfare. That arises under a federal statute, and it is an unbelievably high standard to convince the federal court that your state court conviction should be vacated. But basically, it is a motion to vacate, otherwise known as federal habeas. And the standard is extremely high, just like it is in a state post-conviction. And you very, very, very rarely do these get granted. But it is another mode of review for you as a state court defendant. And if you're convicted in federal court, you can also file a motion to vacate. It's a similar standard. It's under a different statute, but it's essentially the same thing.
And so you can go to the federal courts and file a federal habeas petition only on issues that you have exhausted in state court, which means you have to have raised the issue and taking it all the way up to the Michigan Supreme Court in state court. So you can do that on the direct appeal. So if you know about an issue in time to raise it on direct appeal, then after you're done there, you can, within 1 year, file a federal habeas corpus petition to raise that same issue in front of federal district court. Or if years later you discover a constitutional violation that infected your trial, you still have to raise it first in state court. So you have to file a post-conviction motion in state court, and then raise it and lose it all the way through the state court system. And then again, you have 1 year to file it in federal habeas corpus, federal district court.
Yeah, the classic way that that's done would be a person who has appealed in the state courts and they've lost. So the state courts have upheld their conviction. At that point, they can file what's known as a petition for writ of habeas corpus. And that is section 2254 under 28 U.S. Code, and that basically is saying, let's say I'm in South Carolina and I've been convicted of murder and I've unsuccessfully appealed in South Carolina state court because the exact example I gave before, the police department failed to turn over that someone else confessed to the crime. Well, my claim would be in federal court, I would apply to the United States District Court for the District of South Carolina and say, there's a clear federal law, Brady versus Maryland. It says the prosecution under the Due Process Clause has a duty to turn over material exculpatory evidence, and the state of South Carolina didn't do so. And then my claim would be legally that that was an unreasonable application of clearly defined and established federal law under Brady. And so I would say to the federal court, the South Carolina state courts are misapplying federal law that's clearly established, and as a result, you, the federal court, need to overturn what they did and give me a new trial.
Habeas corpus. What does that mean?
Habeas corpus comes from a Latin phrase meaning you have the body, and the claim is the state has my body, I'm imprisoned, and you, the federal court, I'm asking for relief to release me from incarceration because they unlawfully have my body.
Greg Taylor was the first exoneree to mention the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, but he definitely was not the last or the only one. I needed to know more about this.
Penalty Act of 1996, 1 year after the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. So that was a bill that got at various anti-terrorism things, but Republicans in Congress also tacked on measures to the anti-terrorism part of the bill to limit federal habeas corpus appeals. And the most important limit that they put on it was that you only have 1 year from the end of your state court direct appeals, but the time is stopped while you're pursuing state post-conviction, and the time can be reset if you find new evidence of a constitutional violation and then file a state post-conviction motion. So it's possible to go on federal habeas corpus many years after the conviction if it's based on new evidence that you found years later and then you promptly took it to state court and lost and then went to federal court.
A lot of people call it the AEDPA, and that was passed by Bill Clinton in 1996. And it has indeed made it much more difficult for people to win on appeal. It deals with those habeas petitions that I mentioned before. It had many effects. The two primary ones, one, it made it so that there's a 1 year statute of limitations to appeal from the state judgment. That's tough because, as you said, oftentimes these incarcerees do not have the right to counsel, so they're cobbling together a petition on their own, and that one-year window is often very difficult for them to get that petition in. And there's been a lot of cases where, say, someone has filed the petition 14 months, 13 months, 15 months after what happened in state court, and they're barred from bringing it. The second thing that that act did was it basically raised the standard of proof in order for a federal court to reverse what the state courts did. So you have to prove, as I said before, that there was an error in the application of federal law by the state court. According to the AEDPA, it has to be by clear and convincing evidence, and it has to be such that not just the state court erred, but they acted in a way that no reasonable jurist would do. And so based upon both the statute of limitations being diminished and the standard of proof being raised, it's made it a lot tougher to win on habeas.
I had heard the word vacated used a lot lately, not only by my guests, but also by the attorneys in these interviews.
Vacated means it's overturned. So if a conviction and sentence are vacated, it means that they're thrown out.
So vacated means it's erased, it's wiped from existence, it's as if the defendant was never convicted.
I've been doing a lot of research lately, and I've come across some confusion on exactly what a pardon is. Does it mean that you are being forgiven and therefore admitting guilt, or something different?
Well, first of all, you don't have to admit to anything to get a pardon. I mean, use the word forgive. I guess that's what it is. But basically, I can't envision any person who's looking for some way to get out of jail who would not want a pardon, because that is a sort of non-legal process where you don't have to actually convince the granting authority that there was anything wrong with your trial like you do in an appeal where you're alleging trial court error, or in a post-conviction where you're alleging ineffective assistance of counsel. Pardon is much more of like an equitable remedy, which is infrequently dispensed. I mean, I don't know really anybody who's gotten pardoned except, you know, a handful over the years by the president. In Maryland, we don't see pardons being handed out at all.
Not necessarily. Again, it varies from state to state, but the pardon is a power given to the governor that can be exercised for just about any reason. And so a governor can, and commonly will, grant a pardon to somebody who's guilty, but to say that they're forgiven because of the good work they've done since, they've turned their life around and so forth. But a governor can also issue a pardon for grounds of innocence. And we've had one of these here in Michigan, in fact, one of our clients. And so pardons are given on the ground that it was a wrongful conviction. In fact, I know there was a posthumous pardon given, I believe, to Tim Cole in Texas, who died in prison from asthma, but he was posthumously exonerated of a rape by DNA, and then he was subsequently posthumously pardoned. So the pardon was not forgiveness. The pardon was an acknowledgement that he was innocent.
First of all, a pardon is usually the state or the federal executive officer taking action. So if it's a federal crime, it's the president. If it's a state crime, it is the state governor. And one type of pardon would be a pardon based upon a finding of innocence. So the governor of a state or the president can say, John Doe was convicted of murder, and based upon what's been presented to me, I think he's actually innocent. I'm pardoning him, and I'm declaring him innocent of the crime. The other primary type would be a pardon based upon a finding of rehabilitation, and that would be the case in many jurisdictions where John Doe is, say, convicted in South Carolina, and 30 years later, the governor says he hasn't been convicted again, he's held down a job, he has a family, I'm going to find he's rehabilitated, I'm going to pardon him, and that would have the effect of restoring certain rights that are lost as the result of being a felon.
I had heard another Latin phrase, coram nobis, most recently by William Haughey, and I wanted to know what it meant.
Latin phrase meaning error before us, and the difference between a habeas corpus, what differs with coram nobis is, in most states, coram nobis is a defendant who has been convicted, they've served their sentence, and they've now been released. And after they've been released, their claim is, I'm suffering certain collateral consequences from my conviction, and I'm seeking relief from those collateral consequences.
As a prerequisite to coram nobis, you cannot be serving a sentence. You would be somebody who was out of jail and not on probation or parole in the case that you're trying to challenge. So you could be incarcerated and pursuing a quorum nobis, but you'd have to be incarcerated on another case. There are similar grounds as what you would raise in a state court post-conviction, the difference being that in post-conviction, you actually have to be incarcerated in the case that you're challenging. In quorum nobis, you have to not be incarcerated on the case that you're challenging. And you're challenging your conviction on some sort of fundamental, you know, big constitutional violation. And you have to be suffering adverse collateral consequences from the conviction.
This is an alternative to habeas corpus. And it's in a situation where you can't file a habeas corpus primarily because you're not in custody. So you can only file a habeas corpus petition if you're in custody at the time you file a petition. But there are situations in which you're not in custody. And there's something called a writ of quorum nobis, very, very rare, seldom granted.
So I was just looking at a case recently, actually, in doing some research, and a case involved a defendant who was a resident alien. He pled guilty to a crime, and then he was now facing deportation based upon that conviction. His claim was, I'm seeking quorum nobis relief because my trial attorney didn't advise me that if I plead guilty, that would lead to me being deported. So it's a defendant who's been released after being convicted, and usually, not always, but usually isn't attacking the conviction itself, but is attacking the collateral consequences.
So the two really quick examples that I would give are if you've been convicted and you've already served your time, but later on you wind up having a federal case, and due to your state court conviction from however long ago, your sentence is now being enhanced. You're subject to mandatory penalties or enhanced sentencing as a result of your being like a, you know, second or third or fourth time convicted person. So that case causing you adverse collateral consequences would be the case that you would try to do a quorum nobis petition in and try to get it vacated so that you would not suffer the consequences of having that conviction. Or you're about to be deported because ICE discovers that 27 years ago you had a conviction for assault. And the way to try to get out from under the deportation or the immigration consequences to try to get that conviction vacated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a fairly common one. It would be things such as you're losing your voting rights, you're losing your right to possess a firearm, you're being deported. But something along those lines would be the typical example.
Through Serial, Undisclosed, and other podcasts, I've heard the term Alford plea be mentioned several times. I wanted to know what exactly that meant.
An Alford plea is, practically speaking, the same thing as a guilty plea. It has the same effect in that you, by pleading guilty, are allowing the judge to enter a judgment of conviction and to proceed to sentencing. The difference between a typical guilty plea and an Alford plea is, with an Alford plea, you are saying, I'm pleading guilty. I'm claiming, however, that I'm innocent of the crime, but I'm acknowledging the state has enough evidence to prove my guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's because this is another Brady case, Brady versus U.S. In order for a conviction to be valid, it has to be based upon an adequate factual predicate, because we don't want people confessing and entering a plea if their confession and plea doesn't match the evidence in the case. And Alford is sort of a workaround where it says a person is technically pleading guilty. They are adopting the state's evidence, but they are claiming on their own behalf that they're innocent.
In a case called North Carolina versus Alford, or Alford versus North Carolina, the U.S. Supreme Court nearly 40 or more than 40 years ago said that a state can do that. A state can accept a guilty plea from a defendant who nevertheless claims to be innocent. And recognizing that the defendant, it may be in the defendant's best interest to do that. The defendant may well say, I'm innocent, but recognize that he or she will likely be convicted if they go to trial, and they'd be better off taking the plea and taking the deal. But they can do that and still claim their innocence.
You don't have to admit guilt, and that's what distinguishes it from a regular guilty plea. It has the exact same function and effect as any other guilty plea, but it is a variety of guilty plea and an exception to the norm where you do not have to admit your guilt. You can assert that you are innocent of the crime but that you are nonetheless pleading guilty because you believe that you're just going to get convicted anyway because the state's evidence is going to make it look really bad for you, or you can assert your innocence, but you do not want to put your victim's family through a trial, or you yourself don't want to put your own family through the trial. And the way I think of it and explain it to some of my clients is that if you just absolutely would not consider pleading guilty because you refuse to admit that you did something that you didn't do, but you nonetheless want to reap the benefit of a guilty plea, which is typically a reduced sentence from what you would otherwise face if you went to trial and got convicted. So you want to avail yourself of the benefit of entering a guilty plea, but psychologically, you cannot stomach the idea of admitting to wrongdoing that you didn't commit. The Alford plea is for you. If the court will accept it, a court doesn't always accept an Alford plea. It has to be sort of specifically allowed. The state has to be willing to let you enter it, and the judge has to allow it to happen. If a guilty plea is even on the table, meaning that the state is willing to offer the opportunity to the defendant to plead guilty in exchange for some sort of benefit, you know, like less jail time, you know, usually it's going to be proposed by the defendant, like, okay, I'll consider pleading guilty if you let me do it as an Alford plea. And sometimes the state will say, yeah, okay, we don't really care if you if you want to assert your innocence, whatever. We just want the mechanics of a guilty plea to happen in lieu of a trial. But most of the time, you're not going to see the state approach the defendant and say, we'll allow you to enter an Alford plea, because the benefit is to the defendant. The state doesn't get anything out of it. It's just to kind of make the defendant feel better about not having to admit the guilt. Sometimes it's going to make it more likely for the defendant to plead guilty if that's an option. But it usually comes as a proposal from the defendant.
In many other states, so Alford pleas are pretty much unknown in Michigan because Michigan, like some other states, has instead something called a nolo contendere plea, which is a no contest plea, where again, the defendant does not admit guilt, but says, I acknowledge that there's enough evidence to convict me. And so therefore, I will take the deal and accept the lesser punishment rather than risk going to trial where I'm likely to be convicted, even though I maintain I don't admit I did it. I mean, the difference between nolo contendere and Alford plea is nolo contendere plea, the defendant doesn't admit to guilt. And in the Alford plea, the defendant affirmatively says, I didn't do it. I'm innocent, but I will still accept the conviction.
Then I asked the question, the one that I get more than any. What can we as non-attorneys do to help?
The biggest thing is, if and when you're called for jury duty, to be diligent and make sure that you're being as careful as possible in reviewing the evidence. You can sort of look to the Innocence Project and see why we have so many wrongful convictions. It's based upon false confessions, eyewitness misidentification, faulty forensic evidence. A lot of states have made strides. A lot of other states haven't done so, but there are methods to reduce those wrongful convictions, sequential eyewitness lineups where it's you look at one person at a time as opposed to the standard six people at the same time, recording interrogations, having state bodies that deal with certifying experts, having appeals processes where you have an attorney, having procedures in place such as conviction integrity units that look into wrongful convictions. So in terms of the way you vote, in terms of approaching your local representatives and state representatives and federal representatives so that they move for criminal justice reform, you can volunteer at Innocence Projects, similar organizations, legal clinics. So those types of things where you're becoming more engaged and active in making sure that the system is set up in such a way that we cannot prevent but maybe reduce the number of wrongful convictions.
Really, two things come to mind. One is to recognize the importance of serving on a jury. And I think by default, so many people either try to avoid getting called for jury duty in the first place, like don't register to vote or whatever it is that, you know, puts you on the rolls for being selected as a juror. Or if they are called into jury duty, to try to, by default, get out of jury duty by making up some sort of excuse. You know, the system depends the criminal justice system as well as the civil system depends on people doing their duty. And a person cannot be convicted without the unanimous concurrence of 12 jurors. And so do your duty to help make the system work. You know, you can't, if you're not a lawyer or not a criminal defense attorney, you're probably going to have only limited ability to prevent wrongful convictions, but you can probably do your part by serving on a jury. And you should also exercise your right to vote for your public officials and make sure that your state's attorneys in your particular jurisdiction are the people that you want to have holding that office, and that there are credible and honest people who will, you know, make sure that there's good oversight on the detectives who are investigating criminal cases, and making sure that they're, you know, there's just oversight by the citizenry and reducing the potential for corruption, because there are a lot of people in recent years who have, and these are cases that have gone public, who've been victims of wrongful prosecution in the first place, inadequate, shoddy investigations at the outset, withheld evidence by the prosecution, or, you know, any number of other wrongdoings. And I think we all have an important part to play in making sure that we elect the right people and keep the right people in power.
Well, for the average citizen, it's very difficult. One thing we hope that comes out of the actual innocence cases is an understanding that the criminal justice system, like any other government program, makes mistakes. People are not surprised that the IRS screws up their taxes. People are not surprised if there's a mistake in their Social Security benefits. People shouldn't be surprised when the criminal justice system gets it wrong and goes after the wrong people. And so it's not just about exonerating people, it's about preventing wrongful convictions in the future. And the best way to prevent wrongful convictions in the future is to support legislative and judicial fixes to the system, because we can learn from these cases what goes wrong. So to give some examples, we've learned that certain types of eyewitness identification procedures are particularly prone to bad identifications. And so Michigan has gotten the state police and the people who train police forces statewide on board to institute different eyewitness identification procedures, namely the most important of which is that you record the entire eyewitness identification procedure on video so we can see what happened. And also that the person who administers the eyewitness identification doesn't know who the suspect is. So there's no way that they can inadvertently or advertently cue the witnesses to who they should pick. We've gotten the law enforcement people in the state on board with that. We should videotape all interrogations so we can see when people are being coerced or being fed information if they're a vulnerable person that then becomes part of the confession. We should have a system of indigent defense that provides enough resources for lawyers to investigate cases and adequately defend cases. And Michigan is way behind in that. We have one of the worst systems of indigent defense in the country. So that's a real problem here. A really important one is forensic sciences. People have been convicted on junk science for generations. And in 2009, the National Academy of Sciences issued a report that just excoriated the state of forensic sciences in the United States. And we need top to bottom forensic science reform. And we're starting to see that. We're starting to see the Department of Justice and the National Institutes of Standards and Technology are working on getting real forensic science reform, getting examiners accredited, getting labs accredited, and requiring that they're testifying about actual science and not just junk. But we got a long way to go. The short answer to what can ordinary people do is be aware of these cases and maybe write their local innocence organizations. They can go to the website of the Innocence Network, innocencenetwork.org, find their local innocence organizations, and contact them and say, what is going on legislatively in your state that we can weigh in on, and go up and testify or contact their state representatives or state senators or the governors and say, hey, I want to see eyewitness identification reform, or I want to see forensic science reform, or I want to see a better system of indigent defense in our state, and come out and support these things. It's very hard for, I think, an average citizen to support an individual who may have been wrongfully convicted, because an average citizen is not going to have the means to determine whether that person has a strong or weak case of actual innocence. But they can use these cases and they can follow these cases and use them in efforts to reform the system to prevent the wrongful convictions coming down the pike.
I know that sometimes, after reading about so many wrongful convictions, I feel deflated. I wanted to know how these helpers continue in their profession, so I asked if they could share some memorable stories. Those stories up in just a minute, after I share the answers to frequently asked questions about TJ21.
You might remember TJ from his spot on last week's episode, in which he talked about the many services that his media company provides to consumers. He and I have received a lot of questions about what exactly he does at weddings. And so here's TJ from TJ21 Media Group to explain how they do weddings differently.
The reason why we love doing weddings and what I think sets us apart from everyone else is that we offer a huge gamut of, we start 8 or 9 in the morning when the bride is getting her hair done and her makeup and the bridesmaids. So we're there with 2 to 3 cameras, getting everything. We interview the bride. We set her down. We put lights on her and mic her up. It's a professional setting. And we just ask her, tell me about how you guys met. Tell me about anything that you had to go through to get to this point. Tell me why you love him. And then we do the same thing for the guys. You know, we're getting shots of them putting their shoes on, their coat and everything. And then we interview him. And then we got 3 people spread out, 3 or 4 people spread out for the actual ceremony. So we film the entire ceremony, 3 or 4 different angles, fly our drone. If it's an outdoor wedding, it's beautiful. We fly the drone right over the top. We've done a lot of beach weddings where the drone looks great flying right over and in towards the water. We film the entire wedding. We're there for the entire reception. We miss nothing. And then in the end, we put together several videos. We get the full speeches, the maid of honor and the best man. And then we get the father of the bride doing something. We get the full highlight of the entire day, the full ceremony, the interviews, and basically anything else that we can find. We put this entire package together.
If my listeners wanted to contact you, how would they do that?
The best way to reach us is on our website, tj21.com. We have a huge area on there that about our videos. So that's probably one of the most popular things on our website is our video page. And you click on tj21.com, you click on video and then weddings. And then everything we've done is online, with the exception of that small percentage that have asked that it just be personal, but it's really small. Everything else is on there. And you can watch everything we've done from early days of shooting weddings, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago to the latest things we just filmed last week. Everything is on there in its entirety.
I mean, to take the very recent case of Devante Sanford, that was a case we worked on for 2.5 years and had a terrific result. But, you know, everything went wrong in that case. You had a 14-year-old boy interrogated by police in the middle of the night without a parent or guardian present. You have a manifestly false confession that nobody could have believed to be true from the outset. It was just wrong about so many key details. And yet he was convicted after being represented by a horrifically terrible lawyer. And then 16 days after he was sent to prison for effectively the rest of his life, the police arrested a hitman for another murder. And that guy gets in front of the camera and confesses to 12 murders, including the 4 for which Devante had just been sent off, in great and accurate detail, and leads the police to the murder weapon, one of the 2 murder weapons, and identifies the man who paid for the hit and identifies his accomplice at whose place they found one of the 2 murder weapons. And yet the reaction of the system to that was to cover it up. The reaction of the system was to keep it quiet, that the hitman had confessed not only to the other murders, but to the murders on Runyon Street for which Devante Sanford had been acquitted. So it was almost a year before the defense learned about Vincent Smothers' confessions, and only because somebody leaked it, not because the prosecution or the police revealed it. In fact, what the prosecution and police tried to do was cover it up by offering Smothers a deal to the 8 other murders in order to keep him quiet about the 4 he committed on Runyon Street. And so cases like that are so outrageous, so infuriating. And so it took 8.5 years for Devante Sanford to be free. So he went to jail and then prison as a 14-year-old and is coming out now as a 23-year-old. It shows me how many more people there are like him with cases maybe slightly less outrageous and slightly less blatant. But we're finding no shortage of such cases.
Oof. Well, I mean, yes, so many. I could write many, many books about the cases that interest me and that stand out in my mind. One case that will probably stand out more than anything, but it's like kind of ongoing, so I have to be vague, I guess, about it, is a guy, and it's, you know, coincidentally an assertion of actual innocence, and I do believe that he is actually innocent. And I would not say that about the majority of my clients, and maybe they wouldn't even say that about themselves. And it has nothing to do one way or the other with the nature of the work. But in this particular case, this defendant has maintained his actual innocence from the beginning. He was accused of and convicted of shooting his 2-year-old daughter point blank range, purportedly to avoid having to pay child support. And that was the motive that was attributed to him. And it is forensically and in every other way the most fascinating story that I could imagine anybody ever being able to come up with. I don't think any piece of fiction could be more compelling than this case. But yeah, the state theorized that he took his daughter to the movies and set it up so that he could have an alibi at the movie theater and then took her outside and killed her in the parking lot. And the issue is, aside from the fact that, you know, I 100% don't believe that this person was capable or even had the motive to kill his daughter, but the state proved its case on gunshot residue, and the gunshot residue evidence that the state relied on was basically years later sort of invalidated because the FBI changed its definition of what constitutes gunshot residue in terms of particles and how many particles. And so that particular gunshot residue evidence would not be classified today as gunshot residue. And there were all sorts of, there was just a lot of mishandling of the gunshot residue evidence at the trial. There was also very seriously undermined later testimony about lividity, which is the, when you're killed and the part of the body that is lowest is going to darken from the blood settling. And they use lividity as determining time of death. The medical examiner, years later, we were able to find him in another state, and he came back and by affidavit sort of disavowed the lividity evidence that he gave at the trial. So there are all sorts of issues with time of death and gunshot residue. And I mean, I could go on and on and on. It's really just an incredible case, and witnesses who were not interviewed, who heard gunshots at a different location that corroborated my client's statement of what happened, and the prosecution withheld that evidence and it wasn't discovered until years later. So, you know, that's probably the case that has the most impact on me in terms of lots and lots of fascinating legal and scientific issues, as well as just, you know, flat out couldn't have happened the way the state said it happened, not believing that this defendant was capable of committing such an atrocity. Got all the ingredients of a case I will never forget.
To tell you about one more, we're going to court in 6 weeks for a hearing in the case of Lamar Monson in Detroit, who was convicted of a murder in 1996. And again, based on what was a manifestly false confession taken by a detective who was fired a year later for extracting manifestly false confessions. And the confession claims that Monson stabbed this woman to death, this girl to death. Actually, she was beaten to death with a blunt instrument. But the detective at the time that she generated this false confession, she believed that the victim had been stabbed to death, so that's what the confession says. But 11 days later, the autopsy report comes out, and the girl had been actually beaten to death with a toilet tank lid, a ceramic toilet tank lid. 16 years later, after Monson was convicted, a woman walks into a Detroit police station and reveals that her ex-boyfriend had committed the murder. And we later determined that there was a thumbprint on the bloody toilet tank lid that had never been compared to anybody. And last September, we learned that toilet tank lid fingerprint matched the boyfriend that had been named by the woman in 2012. And yet we're having to go to court to fight for this because the prosecution won't give in. In their view, it's just a hell of a coincidence that the person, the alternative suspect now named by the ex-girlfriend who has no motive to lie for anybody and lived in fear of her life for all those years that the ex-boyfriend was going to kill her because she knew too much. It's just a hell of a coincidence that the guy she names, turns out that's his thumbprint on the bloody murder weapon. So we have to go to court to win this case, and Lamar Monson still sits in prison today while we fight this out.
The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.